216 on the 4th.
This time, we will withdraw amendment number 11, but just for the information of the body.
Present, we have Senator Elton, Olson, Wilken, myself, Chair Dyson.
Madam Clerk, you.
It is my intention for us to answer any questions that committee members who couldn't be here last Monday have on HB 214 anatomical gifts in the registry, and pass that bill if there is the will of the committee. Then somewhat similarly on HJR 20, and then continue the discussion on HB 53. Is that, any objection to that from members of the committee? All right, who's here on HB 214? This was, as was explained to us on Monday, is in essence cleanup legislation on the anatomical gift bill we passed last spring. Is that right?
That's correct.
Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Vanessa Tandini, and I'm staff to Representative Lisa McGuire. And Representative McGuire did present the bill. If you have any questions, or would you like me to go into detail, I'd be happy to.
Maybe you could just briefly summarize the bill.
Sure. Last year, Representative McGuire did pass the anatomical gifts registry bill, and it created a central registry, so when you go to DMV and you can request to be an organ donor, that information would be put into a central database where it would actually make a difference. So if and when something did happen to you, this information could get linked up then to the organ recipient. And since that bill has passed, it's come to Representative McGuire's attention that were a few definitions that needed to be corrected, which this bill does. One is the definition of organ procurement organization, and we changed that to be more inclusive, to allow Life Alaska, which is our in-state donation program, to have access to the database. And also, it expands the definition of technician to accurately reflect that not all technicians that would be harvesting this material are necessarily licensed by the state medical board. And also, it expands the notification requirements, and we also worked with the EMTs to ensure that they were happy and comfortable with what's being asked of them. We really appreciate all that everyone does to see that organ donors' needs are met. And then it just clears up some inconsistencies between federal regulations and state laws.
Other questions? Senator Dr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why are you not requiring the technicians that are harvesting to be licensed?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's my understanding, and let me, hold on one second, and let me just get to my notes here, but it's my understanding that the people that actually harvest the tissue aren't necessarily licensed by the state medical doctor. They're not, and again, hold on, let me.
I guess I wasn't talking about tissue, I was talking more about organs.
Let me just find my notes here.
Obviously, taking a skin graft is a lot different than having a liver transplant.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if also Bruce Sonoritis with Life Alaska might be able to answer that quicker than I, but I know I have the answer some here, and I do apologize for the delay.
Yeah, Bruce, can you hear us?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, did you hear the question, sir?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, I would answer by stating that for organ donation, an example given was the liver for transplant, or the kidney, or heart for transplant, or lung, those organs will be recovered by transplant surgeons or teams who are consistent of transplant surgeons from the transplant institution. In this case, it would be Seattle. So they would be physicians in that case. We're speaking of tissues such as the skin that was mentioned, or corneas for transplant for restoring blindness, or for bone grafts to perform orthopedic surgery. Tissues of this type would be performed by technicians who are not physicians.
And that was Bruce Sonoritis?
Sonoritis, that's correct.
From Life Alaska?
Yes, sir.
Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson. Any other questions? Discussion? Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I was just prepared to move the bill.
I move Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 214 with attached zero fiscal notice.
Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 214 moves. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. All right, now we'll...
Cody's here.
Cody. All right, we'll take up HGR 20. I understand your boss has some experience with this issue.
He's an expert. For the record, Cody Rice, staff to Representative Carl Gatto, who is en route to the meeting, should you need expert testimony. HGR 20 essentially recognizes the fact that there are currently no targeted, as they're called, therapies for prostate cancer. There are specifically targeted therapies, drug therapies, that is, for other specific types of cancer, and this resolution would urge Congress and the FDA to expedite, where possible, the approval of such targeted therapies.
But Cody, aren't they expediting? People dinking around while people are dying?
Through the chair, I think that's debatable, but the facts are that there currently is not approval for prostate cancer, some drugs that are in the latest stages of approval to be used for what's called end-of-life care or compassionate use, I think is the proper term. We have a doctor here, so he could probably tell you better than I could, but I think the term is compassionate use. And for other types of cancer, such as breast cancer, and for some other diseases, such as HIV, there are provisions for compassionate use of drugs that are in the final stages of treatment. Prostate cancer doesn't happen to be one of those groups, and so it is more important that they expedite approval of these drugs.
So is it fair, Cody, to say that this particular drug mentioned on line 6, page 2, is a explicit request in the midst of a general one?
Chair, yes. Zinlay, atrasentan, is the only drug that we were aware of that is specifically targeted for prostate cancer that has been that has reached the later series of trials through the FDA. It's my understanding there may be one other drug out there, and that's why we left the final "be it resolved" more general to say "be it resolved."
Hey, Senator Alton had a question.
Just a statement. I think Cody did a great job of describing, and if I sound like an expert, it's not because I am, but I've been briefed by a constituent and a good friend that I think you have worked with in the past, Mike Miller.
Yep.
And a doctor that accompanied Mike to my office. And I think Cody did a good job of explaining we're not necessarily talking about drugs to inhibit the spread of prostate cancer. We're talking about kind of end-of-life drugs that can provide for compassionate care. To the best of my recollection, there has been no new drug approved for that for the last couple of decades, even though there have been some promising drugs. We're not talking about medicines that can make you live, but we're talking about medicines that can make you live better in advanced stages. Having said that, and I support the bill, I am somewhat uncomfortable with the name of a specific drug in this. Not uncomfortable enough to move an amendment to take it out. But I certainly don't want my support of this resolution to be an endorsement of a drug that I have no understanding of, to indicate that there may not be other drugs out there that should be considered. So I just wanted to make sure that I put that on the record.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Gatto is reportedly trying to get out of the House floor session to come and join us, but I don't know that that's necessary.
Ready for a motion?
Yes, sir. Just Chair, move to report HJR 20 from committee with individual recommendations.
Objection? Seeing none, HJR 20 moves. We'll now resume our hearing on HB 53. Reneva?
Mark them both. Just want to keep you here. I have a feeling that you guys necessarily know I want you guys meeting.
Making the house versions?
I think we're going to.
Did we do this?
No, my fear is that you're going to start looking at projects that should come up.
Well, there probably ought to be that activity also happen. Reneva,
protect the UAF.
Slightly taking advantage of you, but would you kind of re-summarize the little bit of the history of HB 53 and the major things in it? And we have been joined by Senator Green. Welcome.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. As I mentioned the other day to the committee, this bill is probably one of the main reasons that Representative Coghill ran for office to begin with. In 1998, when House Bill 375 was going through the process, Representative Coghill spent about 3 days at the LIO to testify on this issue. And I think it was really one of the main reasons that he filed for office and why he's here now. This House Bill 53 is a consolidation of four different bills: House Bill 17 by Representative Roachberg, House Bill 113 and 114 was introduced through rules for the governor, and then House Bill 53. It also has a couple of items in it that Representative McGuire was anticipating legislation for. The first thing that it did, And to go back to that, the reason we folded all of these bills into one bill is we wanted to make sure that at the end of the day, when five potential bills had passed, that they weren't overlapping with each other or undoing what another bill was doing. So it was just to make sure that everything was done uniformly and without conflicting. The first thing that it does is it eliminates the no duty language that I'm sure all of you are familiar with in 4710-960. It stated that there was no duty or standard of care for children in state custody. While the intentions were good to make sure that the state wouldn't be held liable for failing to meet a timeline that was introduced with House Bill 375, parents took offense to the language. Because it was saying to them that there is a duty and standard of care for parents, and if they don't meet that duty and standard of care, they have their children taken away, but the state didn't have that same duty and standard of care. So this, it does recognize that if timelines are not met, there isn't a civil liability, but it takes out the no duty standard of care language.
Where is that?
That is Section 29.
All I see is it says failure to comply with a provision of this title isn't a basis for civil liability.
Right. And that's speaking of timelines that have been set out in that title. There is a state Supreme Court case, Karen L., that we believe does create a duty and standard of care on the part of the state for that child. So we saw no reason to do anything but say that if it's an administrative issue where they haven't met timelines, there is no civil liability.
Can you tell me or us what the decision of that judge about a standard of care, what does that put before us as a standard of care?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What it did is it stated that it involved a guardian ad litem, but the court recognized that there was a duty and standard of care on the part of that guardian ad litem to the child. So in that, in our opinion, that does create a duty. The court has recognized it.
Okay. I'm confused. If I assumed a standard of care meant you had to keep the kid warm, clothed, and reasonable medical care, what if the birth parent or the custodial parent thinks that a child who's in state custody isn't being cared for in a way that fits the court's definition? Where do you go to look to see what that is?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's written in law anywhere. I think it's just common sense. The parents have a duty and standard of care, and the state should be held to that same standard of care. That includes feeding the child, making sure it has medical attention, a roof over its head. There is some language in this bill that it, addresses placement of children with adult family members that enhances what you did several years ago, that said that poverty is not a reason to terminate parental rights. But on the state's part, and Department of Law can address this if they'd like, I would assume that the court is saying that the state has the same duty and standard of care to that child as the parents should have.
Okay, so there's no absolute 40 rules of what it is for diet or clothes or size of the bedroom?
No.
Yeah, all right. I had a foster child that complained for years about the size of his bedroom. All right.
Another element of this bill is strengthening families. One of these provisions addresses relatives who have taken care of a child for 12 consecutive months. They would naturally have a priority if the state took custody of the child and placed the child out of the home. They would also have a priority for adoption if the state terminated their rights. The adult family member that had been raising that child would have a preference for adoption.
So I assume there that Representative Coghill is wanting whoever has been doing the parenting caring role to be the first option that's considered for continuing that.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. You're seeing a growth in the amount of grandparents who are raising children, and I think you had one testify at the last hearing. So we want to make sure that when another family member steps in to take care of a child that is in need, that they have the ability to continue to do that. This bill provides for the least restrictive placement for a child in close proximity of their parents, and that is so that reunification efforts can be applied to the case. The preferential placement is, first of all, an adult family member, second of all, a family friend, third, a licensed foster home, and last resort would be an institution.
But Reneva, if my memory of the law is correct, if a child is going to be placed with a family friend, that family probably has to go through the foster care licensing process, correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes and no. If they want to be paid to take care of the child, then they would have to be licensed. But I think if they are taking care of the child at their own expense, they have to meet the qualifications of a licensed home, but they don't have to be licensed. And Department of Law could address that too.
My guess is you're wrong, but I...
Mr. Chairman, I was just corrected. The family friend would have to be licensed, but a family member would not.
Okay. All right. Senator Elton.
Thanks. And Reneva, I may have just missed, but you said that one of the criteria is close proximity to the parents to help with reunification. I mean, but there's also the priority for a family member. I mean, what if the family member is in Fairbanks and the child is in Anchorage and the parents are in Anchorage?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's probably something the department should answer, but I think their answer is probably going to be reunification is a priority, so the proximity to their parents would probably be that priority, regardless of if it was a family member or a family friend. Tammy, do you want to come up and address some of these? This is Tammy Sandoval, who is deputy commissioner and is in charge of the Office of Children's Services.
Good afternoon. Through the chair, Senator Elton, that therein lies the struggle with this business of doing this kind of work. The balance of proximity, who's the best placement and the best resource for the child, and keeping kids in close enough area. So we would balance all those things in a decision-making process with supervisors and staff that we have that would help us decide that, along with inviting the parents and the extended family members to the table to so that family members are included in what's the best plan for the child.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
But as I remember, that can be challenged. I mean, doesn't the court get involved here at some point? Let the record note that the Department of Law is agreeing with the chair.
Mr. Chairman, anywhere in this process, there is now a grievance process and the right of a family member to request a hearing if they disagree with what the department is doing. So in 53, there is not only transparency, but there is a clear process that the adult family members and family friends can follow now. Part of the problem with China cases in the past has been that parents and family have a child removed very suddenly. First of all, they're upset. They don't know what their rights are. Up until about 4 years ago, they didn't have a right to a public defender until they could prove that they qualified financially. Now, through legislation that was passed, I believe it was 4 years ago, they immediately have access to a public defender. So this clears the process for them so they have a better idea of what their rights are. And the department, under this legislation, is required to inform parents of their rights and what their options are.
So we worked really hard to get a brochure together that goes to the parent, tells them who to contact, what the process is, and what the expectations are, and so on. Is that still happening, that those are being given to the parents?
Mm-hmm.
And will probably need to be updated if we do this bill?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And by the way, I would enjoy if you would bring a copy of that current one that's in use for our committee members to have a look at. Thank you. Please continue.
Another thing this does is it directs OCS to do everything they can to provide visitations with family and relatives. And again, through this process, they have to advise the family and relatives that, or the parents and relatives, that they have a right to request a hearing if they are denied those visitations, and they have to be told why they were denied.
Yeah. All right. And so if indeed the parent is being investigated for either neglect or crimes against the child, then the decision, the court decision, will be always what's best interest of the child, and the offending parent may be denied visitation, you know, for cause.
That's correct.
You know, if it might further upset the kid or whatever.
That's correct.
But that decision is made by a judge, right?
That is correct. It could be made, initially, it could be made by OCS. But if the parent disagrees with that, then they can request a hearing, and the judge can either confirm OCS's decision or override it and allow the parent visitations.
All right. Please continue.
This bill has a provision that says that parental rights cannot be terminated solely on the basis that they did not receive treatment that was required by the department. And this is because sometimes that treatment isn't available. So it puts more of a burden on the department to make sure that that parent does get the treatment that the department says they have to have. In other words, the department puts together a plan, the parent has to jump through the hoops, but the service isn't there for them to get, so they lose their child.
Okay, but Reneva, suppose the problem is that the parents are drunk. You know, it's a China case, and the kid is being left laying on the floor with dirty diapers for 20 hours at a time, and the department says part of the reunification plan is you got to get dry, and the treatment is not available. you know, so then the department has some responsibility to sit, to find, ascertain that the parent's no longer incompetent because of alcohol. How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, no, that's not what I'm saying. If a parent has an alcohol problem, first of all, you have to determine whether they could afford to do it themselves and if that was available. If it's not available
in your own liquor?
Well, I'm not going to debate that issue. But if the treatment is available and they can pay for it and they don't, then that's clearly a sign that they don't want to get any better. But there is a shortness of alcohol treatment in this state. Shortness of availability, and if they can't afford it, instead of just throwing them out to the wolves and saying we're going to take your children away, more of an effort is going to be made to see that that treatment is made available to the parent. And if they choose not to take the treatment when it's available, then that's clearly another sign that they don't want to change.
But indeed, if some other means they got control of their problem, is there an alternative way to demonstrate that they are, that alcohol is no longer a problem besides graduating from somebody's treatment program?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. If a person can get clean or they can get in control of whatever is going on in their lives in order to safely care for their own children, we'll welcome and entertain any ideas people have to do that. There are non-traditional ways of that people do that, and if they engage in a process with us in the case planning process, absolutely.
All right. Go on.
This bill encourages OCS to provide training for foster parents to become mentors. This is not mandatory. OCS has the right to say a parent could be a risk to bring to expose to foster parents, so they could require supervised visitations. But it does say that OCS would work with public safety and schools to train teachers, but also to train foster parents to be mentors. And part of the reason for this is we were looking at a way, we have seen situations where children have been placed in foster homes that are adoptive homes. And what we have seen, and it's not widespread, but we have seen where foster parents who are adoptive parents discouraged visitation with the parents because their goal from day one was to adopt the child, not to give the child back to the parent under reunification. So the department worked with us, and they felt the best way to do this was to train foster parents to be mentors, to encourage them to work with the parents for reunification. So we've changed that provision. We also tried to figure out how to deal with psychotropic drugs. What we did in the bill is we redefined major medical treatment to include medication used to diagnose, to treat diagnosed mental health disorders.
What section are you in, Reneva?
That is section 15. So what that says is that the parents will participate in decisions for major medical treatments, and that will include psychotropic drugs.
Is major medical treatment a defined or a term of art in law?
Pardon me?
Is major medical treatment defined, or is that a term of art in law?
I believe it's a term of art in law.
But the record reflect nobody's nodding in the audience.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it is. I'm not sure.
Okay. And so some of our legal experts can think about whether that's a problem or not.
The next thing this bill does, Senator, is it makes the process transparent. And this was a key in the governor's legislation that was rolled in here.
And let me say parenthetically, for those of you who weren't here Monday, a major concern of the administration was the big issue that came up with the family in the Mat Valley, where there was lots of accusations about what went wrong and who went wrong. And the department, because of the confidentiality that surrounds all cases with minors, the department could not even clear the record and or defend itself against some real and imaginary oversights. So this is an attempt within the law or within privacy protections to allow some more information to get out and still protect the child?
Correct. Yes.
All right. So what does it do?
There would be some sideboards to public hearings. The hearings are open, but the judge could close a hearing if they felt the child could be stigmatized or emotionally damaged, if it would interfere with a criminal investigation, or if disclosure would violate state or federal law. When a person attends a China hearing, the judge will issue an order that explains what their responsibility is for attending that public hearing, what they can disclose once they've left that room. And if they violate that court order, they can be sanctioned. This bill goes a little further than the original sanction, but if a person violated the order, they could be barred from any future China proceedings, regardless of who the party is. This bill also creates a grievance process that would, if a parent disagrees with what OCS is doing with their child, they can file a grievance with the department, and the supervisor would review the case. Once the supervisor came to a decision, if the parent disagreed further, they could file a complaint with the state review panel that is created in this bill. The state review panel would adopt policy, or they would review policies and procedures of the department, suggest changes in policies and procedures, but they also would be able to set as a panel for an appeal of a grievance. And we have added language in here to subject them to the Open Meetings Act so they would have the ability to meet in an executive session. This bill also, as Mr. Chairman mentioned, would allow OCS to disclose information to the public under certain circumstances. One of those would be if a parent released information, confidential information, to the press about OCS's involvement in a case. Another reason for disclosure would be if the perpetrator has been charged with a crime. And then if a report of harm resulted in death or near fatality, confidential information could be disclosed.
Still, that would not generally mention the name of the child.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The whole crux to this bill is to do everything in the open, but to do nothing, such as release of name, or to do nothing that would bring harm to the child or disclose the child's identity. Part of the legislation, as I said, as far as public safety and OCS working with schools, is the sensitivity of a child being removed from school for the purposes of an interview. To do it in a way that all the other kids in the school don't know what's going on because of how it can stigmatize a child. And that brings us to videotaping and child advocacy centers, which this legislation does recognize as the best way to interview a child. In a home environment that CACs have, and this bill does require videotaping for all cases where there is sexual abuse accused. And it encourages audio taping if videotaping is not available.
Did you hear any testimony that I mean, when we got into this videotaping issue a few years ago, that too tough, hard to get the equipment to everywhere that's close to being a crime scene or where there's victims, too technical, and can't be done. I mean, that's what we heard 7 or 8 years ago. Did you hear any more of that?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't, no.
You could probably do it with their telephone nowadays, couldn't you?
Yeah. This does define child advocacy centers, and like I said, it does establish criteria for schools to follow when a child is interviewed in a school. It provides certain things that are a response to the public. Right now, OCS is required to get back with a mandatory reporter within, I believe it's 10 days. This legislation would require them to respond to a voluntary reporter in 20 days.
So that whoever blows the whistle gets some feedback on what's happened?
Yes.
Whether it's a mandatory reporter or not. And the department's okay with that?
Absolutely.
May your tribe increase. Your predecessors would not have so readily agreed. Thank you.
Last thing I wanted to discuss is a provision in here that allows legislative offices to remain a non-party participant in a case even after parental rights have been terminated. And as I conveyed to you on Monday, this came from a case that Representative Coghill had in Fairbanks where the grandmother had been the primary caretaker. They terminated the parental rights of the parents, and they no longer could work with our office to work with the child and the grandparents. So legislative offices can be advocates for the child even after parental rights were terminated. And Senator Elton mentioned the Ombudsman's office and why they weren't more involved. But the truth of the matter is that when they were reduced in size, more and more parents have gone to the legislative offices for help. And I just wanted to say that Representative Coghill feels that this legislation goes a long way to preserve families and make government accountable. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I'm very interested. Thank you, Renee. You did very well. And the department's take on all this.
We have worked long and hard and very closely with all the legislators that are involved in this bill and feel like we have at every opportunity come to consensus and have come to a place where we agree. We believe that it's best practice. We believe that it furthers our same goals in that children are protected, but families are included, and they are used as resources to try to reunify whenever possible. We wholeheartedly agree with what's happened as a result of House Bill 53. Everything that we started out session with and the governor's bills have been included in this bill, and we're at a good place. We completely and wholeheartedly support House Bill 53.
The world shake for you. This is very different than what things have happened in the last 7 or 8 years I've been here. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could ask the same question of the Department of Law and the court
sure.
system.
And I was going to, but you're, as usual, ahead of me.
Not as usual, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson, this is Jan Rutherdale, sorry. I've been listening too long.
Just Baldy or old.
Technically, thank you. Technically, the Department of Law's position is to offer legal support to the Department of Health and Social Services. I don't know if I can speak on behalf of the department as to having an official position, but I can say that that we've any concerns that we've had in this bill has been resolved, and we think this bill is legally sound and good policy.
Thank you. Boy, I remember, you know, when we were working on 375, the administration strongly not wanting there to be a duty of care, saying this was is going to invite lots of liability suits against, you know, state employees, and don't go there. What's changed?
If Gail Voigtlander is on the telephone, she would probably be the best to speak to that. So I don't. I would defer to her. She's the torts attorney in Department of Law.
Yeah, Dale, Gail, are you there?
She's not online.
All right.
Or Susan Cox. She was. Is she online? Okay. I can generally say that that the provisions that have been the current version of the bill has been modified to the satisfaction of the Department of Law. So. I know. It's a new world. I guess I would like to say that there was a lot of back and forth. The original version that came out was not satisfactory, but through Representative Coghill and the Department of Law working together, we've come up with a compromise that everyone can live with.
All right. Doug, do you have anything to add to this conversation? All right, brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Have we distributed these?
Yeah.
Three possible amendments here. Reneva says she can tell us what's going on. And we'll number them 1, 2, 3 in the order they appear.
Number one, on page 18, line 19, it deletes the word may and inserts the word shall, so that it makes the adoption of regulations to implement the provisions of this bill mandatory, not permissive.
So, do you understand that?
Yes.
And you're okay with that?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Sandy Sandoval.
I'm sorry, Sandy. Unforgivable. All right. Somebody want to offer that? It's yours.
Mr. Chair, I'll move amendment. Should we call it amendment number one?
Yep.
Okay, amendment number one.
Is there objection? Seeing none, dealt with. Reneva.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number two on page 19, and I'm going to change this a little bit after talking to Department Law. Lines 20 through 21 and lines 24 through 25, following the word uncle, delete the words legal guardian. Legal guardians are already parties to the case, and we felt that the legal guardian is not a family member.
All right. Is the department, Sandy, you all right with that?
Yes.
Department of Law?
Yes.
Let the record reflect everybody was nodding. All right, I'll offer amendment number two on page 19, lines 20 and 21, and 25. Following the word uncle, delete the two words legal guardian. Is there objection? Seeing none. All right. Amendment three.
Mr. Chairman, amendment three. In section 10, we had amended section 10 to add this language for hearings to be closed to the public under certain circumstances. So we wanted to make sure that the language in section 52, which is the court rule that deals with section 10, was consistent. So on page 27, line 15, following the word violence, we have added or whose safety or welfare may be endangered by public release of information.
Sandy, you're all right with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Department of Law?
Yes.
All right. Somebody like to offer that?
Amendment number three.
Senator Green has offered amendment number three. Is there objection? Seeing none, it's adopted. What else? I have online Gail Voigtlander and Linda Wilson to answer questions. Do you want to repeat your question?
Was your question, I think, Mr. Chair, on the torts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Either Gail or Linda, this is Dyson. I asked years ago when we worked on a child protection law, there was a great deal of concern that establishing a standard of care for children in custody would invite lots of lawsuits. Would either of you care to comment on that?
This is Gail Voigtlander, Representative Dyson. I understand the question, and over the years there have been concerns, and the concerns have been when the language in AS 4710960, as it currently exists, was going to be changed, because the problem was if you were going to be creating a cause of action for children, parents, other people who are involved in the China proceedings to file litigation against the department and the social workers based upon the statutes and the various steps and procedures that are supposed to be followed in the statute. And it was for that reason that AS 4710960 was put into place, which was to say that the intent was to say that a failure to comply with the provision of the title would not be the basis for, you know, to make a claim for damages. And over the years with that AS 4710960, there was a way that lay people would read that language and it caused them concern. But the underlying legal reason was that it was not to create statutory claims to be made by parents or grandparents or others for damages, because this is an entire statutory scheme where if there are problems with placements, if there's problems with resources being provided or not being provided, the appropriate place to bring that is to the court in the China proceeding. The court has the ability to address those issues, and in fact, the parties have the ability to take an interlocutory, which means like an interim appeal on those issues if they're unhappy. And so what Section 29, going back to this bill, what Section 29 of this bill achieves is that same result of what 4710960 had intended, but because of the use of language, it was causing people concern. Our Supreme Court has said that in terms of child protection, the department and its employees have a duty that they owe to the child, and not a duty that they owe to other parties in the China proceeding, because everyone is represented in these proceedings. Everyone advocates for their own particular position. The parent may not want to have the rights terminated, but it may be in the best interest of the child that those parental rights are terminated. So our Supreme Court has said that because of these conflicts, the duty that is owed by the department is to the child, and that's for reasonable care of the child. And so this language in Section 29 we are satisfied with because it carries over the same concept we had before while changing the language so that it achieves the legal end we need without causing people to have emotional reaction to the language that was used.
Thank you. Are there questions? All right. Any further questions from the committee? What's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move CS for House Bill 53 out of committee with individual recommendation and accompanying fiscal notes.
Objection? Seeing. Where does it go? Judiciary? It goes to judiciary. And we have an accompanying fiscal note. Seeing and hearing no objection, the bill moves. We have not dealt with. I'm on to the Board of Regents, I'm told, has been withdrawn. And we're waiting for another one to come forward and have not been notified of that yet. We are adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you for being here.